On September 22nd, in another California town, San Francisco, another radical, another gun, the same president. Sarah Jane Moore's motives were confused. Her purpose was not.
I knew that that's the only shot I would have was a headshot. He came out, looked right at me, and after I fired the shot, he stopped cold, and I did have time for a second shot, had never planned for a second shot, had practiced and was psyched for one shot.
One shot might have done it if it hadn't been for a man who almost wasn't there. Vietnam veteran Oliver Semple just happened to be downtown.
I said, well, the guy's from Michigan. I've never seen him in person. I'll stick around to see him, you know, if I can see what his hit looks like. Everybody started pushing everybody. For some strange reason, I looked down, and I had seen Sarah Jane Moore go in her purse and pull a revolver. I yelled, "The bitch has got a gun," before I made the lunge for it, as the trigger was going off. I grabbed her, and about 10 agents and 20 police were on us all, like, just like that. Yeah.
That's the one regret I have, that it was not successful.
February 2nd, 1989, San Francisco, California. An apartment slightly outside of the city's infamous Tenderloin District. A man named Wayne quietly enters. He's making a welfare check on a friend of his whom he hasn't heard from in quite some time. A friend named Oliver. Oliver has been down on his luck for too many years now. He's a disabled veteran, an ex-Marine with substance abuse and mental health issues. Issues that he's always felt the media are partially to blame for. Wayne notices an awful smell as he makes his way through the cramped, threadbare apartment. The worst has come to pass. He finds his friend dead, a Jack Daniels bottle by his side, and his blaring TV as his only companion in death. And judging by the condition of the body, it's been more than a few days. Later, Oliver's friends will go through his things. They'll find numerous newspaper and magazine clippings about Oliver and a particular event in his life. Most impressively, they'll find a letter. It reads, "I want you to know how much I appreciated your selfless actions last Monday. The events were a shock to us all, but you acted quickly and without fear for your own safety. By doing so, you helped to avert danger to me and to others in the crowd. You have my heartfelt appreciation." It was on White House stationery and signed President Gerald Ford. Happy Pride! You're listening to Wicked Good Gay, a true crime podcast about gay people doing amazing, incredible, historic, heroic things. Hello. And welcome to the fifth season premiere of Wicked Gay. That's right, five seasons. I'm your host, Jay Harvey, and seriously, I'm a depressed, anxiety-disordered, ne'er-do-well writer who can't even finish a short story. But somehow I made it to five seasons of this shit. Go me. And because Wicked Gay's newest season is beginning during Pride Month, I'm opening with an edition of Wicked Good Gay. That's where instead of spotlighting the heinous deeds of a queer-centric creep, I'm celebrating the accomplishments of a heroic one. But first, an announcement. Wicked Gay has a Patreon. I know, it's true. I can't tell you the internal struggle I have with myself with this Patreon business, but someone pointed out to me that it's kind of a solid way for my listeners to support the show and encourage me to keep going with it. Plus, there's going to be two tiers on it. There's like a thank you tier and a wow boy, howdy am I grateful, and I will shout you out and lavish praise on you. And then there's the oh wow, thank you tier. That second tier, the main tier, gets you even more Wicked Gay. Yes, it's true. Subscribers will have access to a bonus episode of Wicked Gay every month. I'm calling that version Wicked Gay, calling that Wicked Gay Plus version, if you will, the tally. And I'm gonna kind of broaden the storytelling horizons with some queer-centric stories that don't just feature the bad guy being gay. that actually might sort of bleed out into OG Wikigay too here, because there's stories I want to tell that don't necessarily fit the niche I've carved for myself, you know, with all the evil gays. Anyway, Wikigay's Patreon link will be in the show notes of any podcatcher I can shove them into,
wherever they can be shoved.
I'm also going to be putting some bonus content on there for episodes I've already done. Quick little hits with stories and updates about my subjects that I couldn't fit in the original episodes. I'm also debating doing more pop culture-y things that tickle my fancy. And what the fuck does that phrase even mean? It sounds gross. Anyway, fun stuff on Patreon if you're into it. And there's an episode up already up there about Robert Opel, who was the Oscar streaker, who it turns out had like a fascinating, fabulous, kind of anarchist, sexy life, and had a kind of a horrible ending, which, yeah. And there's also a story on there about me being naked. So, hey, check it out. That's really not the draw, is it? No, probably not. Okay. And never fear, this queer hair will always make sure Wikigay, the original, will be free of charge for you ever after. Amen, I promise.
And one more thing. Let's protect trans people. How about it? It's Pride Month. We need Pride more than ever because people are out there trying to literally eradicate trans people. That was the word he used, right? Eradicate? Which should be kind of a ploy shockingly familiar to Jewish people who lived in Germany around 39 to 45. Sounds a little familiar, doesn't it? Anyway, please, let's protect trans people. Show some empathy and kindness, educate ourselves, that kind of thing. And if you want to help out, go to transequality.org and maybe donate. In fact, you know what? Screw my Patreon. Hold off on that. Maybe pass a couple of coins their way to help protect trans people. Thank you.
And now, if any of you are still listening, this is episode 41. The Bitch Has a Gun. Oliver Sipple.
My sources for this episode were YouTube, Wikipedia, NPR, All That's Interesting, and The New York Times, History on the Net, and another, probably better podcast called Radiolab. It had a fascinating interview with Sarah Jane Moore after she got out of prison. Oliver Sipple was a military veteran who resided in San Francisco. On September 2nd, 1975, Oliver was present when a 40-something matron named Sarah Jane Moore tried to assassinate then-President Gerald Ford. Oliver Sipple saved him, so this is a hero narrative, except it's also a story about how Oliver's personal life and a dismissal of his need for privacy came to overshadow his heroic act and alter the course of his life. You see, Oliver was gay, which was okay if he lived in San Fran, which is the kind of the gay mecca at the time, but not something one might be thrilled about having out there in the national news. It's kind of ironic, a man that is generally considered a hero and trailblazer to the gay community was a friend of Oliver's, and this guy decided that Oliver's potential as a symbol for progress outweighed his own wishes and right to privacy. That friend was Harvey Milk, and what he did to Oliver in retrospect was not so heroic. Oliver's resultant outing in the press demonstrated how the queer people were treated very differently back then than straight folk. Let's just say he wasn't invited to the White House to accept Gerald Ford's thank you in person as others would have been. And unfortunately, it also preceded some very serious personal problems for Oliver, including estrangement from his family and struggles with substances and mental health issues, and ultimately led to what could be considered an early death. Let's meet Oliver. Oliver Sipple was born in Detroit, Michigan on November 20th, 1941. He was one of eight kids in a working-class family. As you heard in that opening clip, the only reason Oliver went downtown the day of the attempted assassination was because President Ford was raised in Michigan like Oliver. So he thought, let's check him out. And I think that's like the cutest reason to go see a president. Oliver served as in the United States Marine Corps and fought in Vietnam, where he was injured by shrapnel during his second tour of duty, which he finished in a Philadelphia Veterans Hospital due to his injuries, which rendered him disabled and, of course, a decorated veteran. Sipple was released in March of 1970 and eventually settled in San Francisco, where he went by Billy, not Oliver. He identified as gay, but he was closeted to his family and other straight acquaintances. But this didn't mean that Oliver opted out of being a part of his community. He actually met his friend Harvey Milk in New York City, where if you'll recall, Harvey first began his career as a hippie activist before moving to San Fran, cutting his hair, and getting into politics to change the system from within. Oliver and Harvey had dated the same guy back at NYC, and they ended up becoming friends over it. Once settled in San Francisco, Oliver was someone who helped with the cause. He participated in gay pride parades, demonstrations for equal rights, and he worked on Harvey's successful campaign to be elected to San Francisco's Board of Supervisors, which made him the first openly gay person to serve in a political office in California, and I think like the third in the country. Oliver himself worked in a gay bar. He was also involved with the Imperial Court. So if you're not sure what the Imperial Court is, it's like a gay philanthropic social group that actually works as if they were a royal court, where they dress up as if, I'm talking like Henry VIII and his like beheaded wives, that kind of vibe. So it's actually kind of a spectacle, and they're one of the longest existing gay groups in the country. They're really interesting. So in 75, Oliver lived with a merchant seaman. I'm not sure if this was a roommate sitch or a friend sitch or a lover sitch, but they lived in a fourth floor walk-up in the city, in the city's Mission District. And it reads like many vets, Oliver struggled with mental health issues post-Vietnam. I had an uncle who did two tours of duty in Vietnam, and I can recall he's no longer with us. He was a cool, snarky, just funny guy, and I really look up to him. And my dad would tell me horror stories of how when he came back after the first tour, his PTSD was so bad that he actually went back to Vietnam to, I guess, feel normal. I don't know, but that's horrible. And as you know, the treatment of veterans post-Vietnam at the time was deplorable. And not only were there not a lot of resources for them, but people were like actively hostile towards them. So if you can imagine fighting for your country, risking your life, seeing your friends' lives snuffed out, and then coming back to the country and people like yelling at you about it, that's gotta suck. Anyway, so Oliver did spend some time in San Francisco's VA hospital for what I inferred were mental health issues. And he was readmitted in 75, which is the year he saved President Gerald Ford's life. So he was already in a precarious situation mentally when all this went down. And he still did the brave thing. You know, the second I saw even a like the glint of a gun barrel, I would have been George Costanza-ing over these hoes to get into the BART subway system. I probably would have gotten out yelling, "The bitch had a gun," but then I would have like, you know, run quickly away from the danger and hid behind like a bucket or something. I don't know, a bucket? What are you talking about? A wall? A fence? I don't know. But yeah, so Oliver gets my respect. So because Jerry Ford was from Grand Rapids or whatever, Oliver decided, hey, a fellow Detroitan, let me go down there and check him out. So Oliver goes down to see Ford at the St. Francis Hotel, who was giving an address to the World Affairs Council. And that's when his destiny collided with the destiny of Miss Sarah Jane Moore. So, a couple of things you should know. Earlier that month, on September 5th, 1975, there had been a first assassination attempt on Gerald Ford in Sacramento, California. Yes, this president was shot at twice in one month. So I guess a not very popular president. Worse than Biden, right? Yes. And both the assassins were female, so apparently not the feminist candidate for president. The first assassin, interestingly enough, was known as one Lynette Frome, aka Squeaky Frome. And anyone into true crime or just really big historical crime stories will recognize Squeaky as Charlie Manson's head cheerleader. Yes, one of the bigger names in the Manson family. In fact, after Manson got busted, she was sort of the de facto leader of the Manson family. And, you know, she kind of hung in there as the family spokesperson while her guru and brothers and sisters were all on trial for some truly horrendous crimes. She kind of kept the home fires burning. She issued death threats. She actually committed attempted murder by way of a Hawaiian vacation and a hamburger loaded with 10 tabs of LSD. And look that up sometime. And generally making a scary nuisance of herself because she was so in love with little Charlie. But by 75, the world had sort of moved on. So Miss Frome, who was living in Sacramento at the time, went to the park that Ford was appearing at, dressed in a big red gown and a peaked red cap, and she aimed a gun at Ford, which somehow jammed and was then slapped out of her hand by a Secret Service agent. She served many years in prison, but I think she's been paroled since then, And, you know, her efforts, her attempted assassination, she basically was able to outshine Charlie Manson. She made the cover of either Time or Life. I mean, she's a character in a Sondheim musical. I'd also like to add that my favorite Squeaky story, if you can have a favorite Squeaky Frome story, is when she was on trial for something, maybe this, I'm not sure, for the assassination attempt. During the trial, she was like testifying, and she said something to the effect of, "The facts in this case are as clear as the piano you can see in the judge's living room through his front window." She basically let the judge know that she knew exactly what his house looked like and what the inside of his house looked like to threaten him. I mean, that's like evil, whatever, but that's also kind of a baller move. So that was earlier in the month. Now we come to the 22nd and the St. Francis Hotel and Sarah Jane Moore, who is fascinating enough that I'm going to get into her story because she's sort of like if Maud turned to firearms. And as far as I know, she's still kicking at age 93. Sarah Jane Moore was born to a Christian family in Charleston, West Virginia, had kind of an interesting path through life. Well, that's calling it one thing. She initially wanted to be an actress and ended up being a nursing school student, a Women's Army Corps recruit, and an accountant. She was divorced 5 times. She'd been married to men that included a doctor and a Hollywood executive. She had 4 children, one whom she was raising, the other 3 were being raised by her parents, before she turned to leftist politics in 1975. After her arrest, Sarah's friend said she had a fascination and an obsession with Patty Hearst. Patty Hearst, as you probably know, was the heiress to the Hearst newspaper fortune, who had been kidnapped by the Symbionese Liberation Army, aka the SLA, in February of 74. This is a very famous story where she was held prisoner and allegedly brainwashed into becoming a bank-robbing revolutionary in a beret holding a submachine gun named Tanya. She was called Tanya, not the gun. In response to the SLA claiming that Patty's dad, who was a rich newspaper guy, Randolph Hearst, was committing crimes against the people by way of being an ultra-rich white guy. In response, Randolph created an organization called PIN, People in Need, to feed the poor and hungry to get Patty back into the fold to the family. Sarah Jane Moore, who, yes, had discovered revolutionary politics, but didn't have an affiliation with the SLA, she became a volunteer bookkeeper for PIN. This was also around the time she claims, and I think this has been proven, to have become an FBI informant. So, it's the early 70s. Sarah is making all these lefty friends, and supposedly she was approached by the FBI to infiltrate and spy on leftist radical organizations for them, which might have included PIN, I'm not sure, which she did. So, despite sharing political views with these groups, I don't know where her head was. She was sort of straddling both sides. But 4 months before she aimed her gun at Ford, the FBI cut off their relationship with her. And she later explained that she took this to mean they were going to kill her. As she said in a 1982 interview from jail, "I was going to go down anyway. If the government was going to kill me, I was going to make some kind of statement." So Sarah had some stuff going on with her. As it would later turn out, the Secret Service had been tipped off by the FBI that Sarah was a little daffy, as my mom would say. They supposedly evaluated her that year to make sure she wasn't a danger and decided that she wasn't. They might have wanted to have checked their work because the day before Oliver Sipple called her a bitch in public, she was picked up on an illegal handgun charge but released. The police confiscated her .44 caliber revolver and 113 rounds of ammunition. So on that fateful day, September 22nd, 1975, Sarah's on the sidewalk across the street from the St. Francis Hotel. At 3:30 p.m., after speaking to the World Affairs Council, Ford comes out from the Post Street entrance of the hotel. It's located in San Francisco's Union Square, and he walked toward his limo. Before getting in, though, he stopped to wave to the crowd that had gathered across the street. And in that crowd was Sarah, and behind her, a little ways, Oliver Sipple. So Sarah is 40 feet away from President Gerald Ford as he waves to the crowd. She takes a .38 Special out of her purse, aims, and fires. She misses the president's head by an estimated 5 inches, and the bullet goes through the wall above the doorway he just came out of. Oliver Sipple, decorated Vietnam veteran and ex-Marine, sees her raise her hand for another shot. He screams, "The bitch has a gun," which must have added to the general confusion and mayhem because there's this picture of the whole situation, like literally a picture of Oliver Sipple lunging for Sarah. I actually already put this on Wikigay's social media platforms, but there's this photo, and in between Oliver and Sarah is this wonderful woman. And she's dressed in like this prototypical 70s outfit, this like big coat with like monochromatic stripes on it and like one of those like bucket hats. It's like an upside down tulip. And she's like running for her life. She's hauling ass out of there. And who can blame her, because some crazy heifer has a gun behind her, right? So as the story goes, Oliver grabs her arm so her second shot wouldn't hit the prez. He said at the time, "I saw her gun pointed out there and I grabbed for it. I lunged and grabbed the woman's arm and the gun went off. It didn't hit the president. However, it did hit a cab driver, 42-year-old John Ludwig, who was standing inside the St. Francis Hotel. He took a bullet to the groin." Ow. And historically, cab drivers don't have a lot of luck in San Francisco. Look up the Zodiac case sometime. Oliver was relieved of duty by a platoon of Secret Service agents and cops who tackled Sarah's ass. There's a picture of that too. The gun was snatched out of her hand, wrestled away from her. Meanwhile, the Secret Service team trundled Ford's ass into his limo, and that raced away towards the airport. Inside, the Secret Service and his chief of staff and future Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, all dogpiled on top of him. And the story goes that there were so many dudes on top of him, sounds hot, I'm kidding, that he said that he was being crushed to death and then snarked that the car was armor-plated, so he wasn't in any more danger, and told them all to get off him now. Sarah always claimed that she was a pretty good shot. The only reason she missed Ford's head was because she was using a gun she'd bought in haste the same morning and didn't know the sights were 6 inches off the point of impact at that distance. In fact, she told the cops, "If I had had my .44 with me, I would have caught him." An FBI agent later agreed with her assessment. He said, "She would have had at least a headshot, maybe even better because she'd been practicing. Her shot was off about 5 to 6 inches. At her sentencing hearing, Moore said, "Am I sorry I tried? Yes and no. Yes, because it accomplished little except to throw away the rest of my life. And no, I'm not sorry I tried, because at the time, it seemed a correct expression of my anger." Sarah served her term at the Federal Women's Prison in Dublin, California. She was paroled in 2009 and did the press rounds, and kept saying she hoped to have sparked a revolution by murdering the president. And along with Squeaky Frome from 17 Days Before, she too is immortalized in the late great Stephen Sondheim's musical about presidential assassins called, economically enough, Assassins. So while the cops are carting Miss Sarah away, they also grabbed Oliver because they had no clue what was going on. And they took him into the hotel to question him, and he's freaked out because he had major PTSD and there was just some shooting. And he's basically had just been going for a walk to see the president wave to him. So he's questioned for 3 hours. He goes home and there's a reporter waiting for him, whom he says to, "I'm a coward. I don't know why I did it. It was the thing to do at the time." Then the phone calls from the press started and they find out that he's a Marine. So they ask him if his training kicked in, but he says, "I'm no hero or nothing." And then he asks them to keep that he's a Marine out of it. So the police and the Secret Service immediately publicly commend Oliver for his actions, and then so do the media. The national news media, in a span of like a couple days or a day, portrayed Seppel as a hero and noted his status as a former Marine. However, as I said, while he was a fairly prominent member of San Francisco's gay community, he wasn't out to his family, specifically his mom. He was also not out to his current employer, not the gay bar he worked somewhere else where I guess they thought he was straight. He asked reporters to keep his sexuality out of stories about him. That stood for about a day. Okay, so the San Francisco Chronicle had a widely read columnist named Herb Kane. Speaking of the Zodiac, he was one of the people that got name dropped in the Zodiac code letter by the killer, Small World. Herb Kane's answering machine, that was kind of like voicemail back in the dinosaur era for you younger people, had 2 messages on it the next day, both of them outing Oliver to him. One was from Reverend Ray Brochiers, the head of a gay activist group called the Lavender Panthers. The other talking about Oliver and how he was gay. The other was from one Harvey Milk. As was revealed later, Milk allegedly told a friend that, quote, "It's too good an opportunity. For once we can show that gays do heroic things, not just all that caca about molesting children and hanging out in bathrooms." He later explained that he outed his friend in order to portray him as a gay hero and to break the stereotype of homosexuals being timid, weak, and unheroic figures. Okay, in my opinion, this was a real dick move on Harvey Milk's part. and you'll notice this unsavory behavior didn't make it into that movie about him. Outing is a shitty thing to do, unless you're one of those sewage people who are closeted and actively making life difficult for gay people because you're a hypocrite hellspawn. Those people can be outed. Anyone else? No. We have to let people come out when they're ready on their own time, and we should all work against our insatiable curiosity and need to define and label people before they're ready, right? I know, I tend towards the same thing. I want everybody to be gay so there's more of us, so we're more normalized, or I did back in the day. Now I don't care anymore. So, whether the falling was coincidental or not, Sipple, after being acknowledged as a hero, probably saved Ford's life. Well, this is according to historian Harold Evans. There was no invitation to the White House for Sipple, not even a commendation. Milk made a fuss about that. Finally, weeks later, Sipple received a brief note of thanks. And there was some discrepancy about this because another source said that that Ford sent a note to Oliver 3 days later. It was the one that his friend found after his death. So the timing here probably does matter. Was it just one of those things and they just neglected to make a big deal of it? Or was it actually weeks later? Because 10 days after Herb Cain received those answering machine messages, he outed Oliver publicly in his column. He noted that Oliver was a close personal friend of Harvey Milk and speculated that Ford offered his praise quietly because Oliver was gay. He wrote, "One of the heroes of the day, Oliver Billy Sipple, the ex-Marine who grabbed Sarah Jane Moore's arm just as her gun was fired, and therefore may have saved the president's life, was the center of midnight attention at the Red Lantern, a Golden Gate Avenue bar he favors. Reverend Ray Brochiers, head of Helping Hand Center, and gay politico Harvey Milk, who claimed to be among Sipple's close friends, described themselves as proud. Maybe this will help break the stereotype." When Cain outed Oliver, the press got even more interested. The heroic ex-Marine who is now a big homo to boot. Great news story for 75, right? Reporters began referring to him as the gay ex-Marine and really stalking him, and he had to go into hiding. The LA Times picked up the story and it went nationwide. Worse, the press got back to his family and his mom refused to speak to him. In fact, she disparaged and disowned him. When reporters couldn't find Oliver after he hid out at a friend's apartment, they went to Harvey Milk. So, Milk suggested that Sipple's sexual orientation was the reason he received only a note from Ford rather than an invitation to the White House. Oliver got a lawyer and he held a press conference. Here's the statement he read with the help of his lawyer. "In the past few days, I have been asked many questions having to do with my sexual preferences. I have been asked whether or not I am gay or homosexual. My sexual orientation has nothing at all to do with saving the president's life, just as the color of my eyes or my race has nothing to do with what happened in front of the St. Francis Hotel on Tuesday. My sexuality is a part of my private life and has no bearing on my response to the act of a person seeking to take the life of another. I am first and foremost a human being who enjoys and respects life. I feel that a person's worth is determined by how he or she responds to the world in which they live, not how or with whom a private life is shared." He also added a sad part, which was obviously hurting the guy's heart. And let me say, everyone's experience is different, absolutely, but there can be a general through line when you're queer, like, is my family going to reject me when they find out? Are they going to treat me differently? Are they not going to see me the same ever again? Or even, like, you know, acknowledge my existence anymore? And you can imagine how it feels when your worst fear comes true. I mean, it was his mom. So he said, "I want you to know that my mother told me today that she could not walk out of her front door or even go to church because of the pressures she feels because of the press stories concerning my sexual orientation. Naturally, I never anticipated such interference with my family's relationship when I supposedly saved the president's life." Oliver added that he was very emotionally shook up and that he felt very sorry for his family and that it was just awful and had nothing more to say. This is even sadder in a way. It was discovered years later that in the Gerald Ford Library, there was a letter from Oliver to Ford. He wrote him back after Ford thanked him with that brief note, and Oliver wrote, "Dear Mr. President, thank you for taking the time to write to me. In view of some of the events since the unfortunate attempt on your life on Monday, September 22nd, I really appreciate your publicly thanking me. As you probably know, there have been a number of stories concerning my personal sexual orientation in the news media. These stories have caused great anguish to my parents and to the rest of my family, I am sure. My mother hung up on me when I first called her after these stories began to be published. I know you are concerned with very many matters which are too important and pressing for you to be concerned with the details of my private life. However, the unexpected and glaring publicity which has been given to my private life has very seriously disrupted my family relationships. Mr. President, it is a very hard thing to have your mother and family not want to have any contact with you. I know that your schedule is heavily occupied, but I respectfully request that you take the time to see my family, or at least call my family. The telephone number is, he gave the number. Then he said, I love my family, and I do not want to be separated from their love and companionship. Your help would be greatly, gratefully appreciated. Respectfully, Oliver W. Sipple. Well, that's a fucking tearjerker. And on the same day he sent that letter, by the way, Ford did not get in touch with the Sipple family, things turned even uglier, and Oliver sued the San Francisco Chronicle, filing a $15 million invasion of privacy suit against Kane, as well as seven other newspapers and a number of unnamed publishers for outing him. In his deposition, Oliver was quoted as saying, I have made my home approximately 1,800 miles away from my home, the home of my parents and my family, so that I could move somewhat freely in the gay community without the fact of my sexual orientation getting back to my parents or family, which unfortunately for him, they did. Because the damage was done as far as the family was concerned, Oliver did go through a period of estrangement with his parents. But supposedly in some stories, the family later reconciled with him. His brother George told the Washington Post in 2009 that our parents accepted it. That was all. They didn't like it, but they still accepted it. He was welcomed. One thing was, don't bring a lot of your friends around. However, other sources said that Sipple's parents never fully accepted him. His mother, just after news of his orientation broke, hung up on him, saying she never wished to speak to him again. His father is said to have told Sipple's brother to, quote, forget he had a brother. And finally, when his mother died, his father did not allow him to attend her funeral, supposedly, which, that's ow. And all the negative attention and the break with his family really damaged him. After his ordeal, he began drinking heavily and let himself go physically. And after his mental and physical health sharply declined, he was diagnosed with schizophrenia and also fitted with a pacemaker. Things were so bad and the attention that the incident brought him were so negative that later in life, while he was drinking, he would express regret about grabbing Moore's gun and saving the president's life. Supposedly, he was so traumatized by what happened, they tried to go back in the closet, so his gay friends kind of dumped him. Although he and Harvey remained friends up until Harvey was assassinated and Oliver did attend his funeral. In other bad news, the Superior Court in San Francisco dismissed his lawsuit, but Oliver would continue his legal battle until May of 84, when a state court of appeals ruled that Sipple had indeed become news and that his sexual orientation was part of the story. And then, February 2nd, 1989, his friend Wayne found Oliver dead in his apartment, 47 years old, with, like I said, a bottle of Jack Daniels next to him and the television still on. The coroner estimated that he'd been dead for approximately 10 days. More ow. And that guy, Wayne, who found him, Oliver's friend, spoke to the press afterwards and had some stuff to say about Oliver. And the following contains a pejorative for gay people, so just warning you ahead of time. He said, and after this thing with Ford, it really fucked his mind up. Sipple was a broken guy after that. The whole thing worked him. The publicity of it all, and the fact that everyone knew he was a faggot, you know? He said to me a couple of times, I went to the Marine Corps and I got hurt. And now what am I known for? For being a faggot. And I'd say, no, you're not. You're known for saving the president's life. You won't be known for what you did in bed, for Christ's sake. But he would get drunk and he'd start bemoaning that. I'd sit there in the bar with him and I'd talk to him about it. Hey man, it is what it is. But he was just down to nothing. This thing happened and it overcame him. It was too much for him to handle. And I think he got to feeling sorry for himself and his family. Just many a night, I would sit in the bar with Bill Sipple and he'd cry on your shoulder and you'd say, okay, Sipple, time to go home. Then I'd drive him home. Oliver was buried in Golden Gate National Cemetery in San Bruno, and Wayne afterwards talked about what the service was like. He said, and I remember that it was very small. The casket wasn't opened. The funeral was just, I mean, there were more media there than anything else. I've seen him buy drinks for more people than were at that funeral. He could have been buried in Arlington if they made a big issue out of it. I mean, shit, there he was, this national icon, a gay whatever, and there were just a few people out there for the funeral. Gerald Ford and his wife sent a letter of sympathy to Sipple's family and friends, and it was on display for a short period after his death at a bar in San Fran called the New Bell Saloon. It read, Mrs. Ford and I express our deepest sympathy in this time of sorrow involving your friend's passing. And an interesting postscript to Ford's part in this. In a 2001 interview, former President Ford disputed that the claim that Sybil was treated differently because of his sexual orientation, saying, "As far as I was concerned, I had done the right thing and the matter was ended. I didn't learn until sometime later, I can't remember when, that he was gay. I don't know where anyone got the crazy idea I was prejudiced and wanted to exclude gays." I guess judge for yourself. And that's Oliver Sybil's story. Thank you for joining me for Wicked Gay's fifth season premiere. Subscribe to Wicked Gay on Patreon now to listen to the very first Wicked Gay the Tally episode about Oscar streaker Robert Opel. You can find the link to Wicked Gay's Patreon page in the show notes on Wicked Gay's page on Buzzsprout, as well as in the bio of all of Wicked Gay's social media profiles under Wicked Gay Pod on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And if you still can't find it, email me at wickedgaypod@gmail.com and I'll send it to you. By the way, I'm also on TikTok, where I've been posting these, I guess you can call them audiograms of past episodes with some amusing like photo montages, and they're kind of worth a look listen, so check them out now, Wicked Gay Pod on TikTok. As always, Wicked Gay's theme song is by Gino and the Goons, additional music by JB, and a neat little AI called Iva. Cover art by Paul Chapman, and sound engineering by the other Mr. Harvey. Happy Pride Month, kids. Wear your colors proudly, and special thank you to our straight allies. And let's help protect trans people, okay? Let's look out for each other, the way Oliver did for President Ford, because in the end, we're all we have. Night. You've been listening to Wicked Good Gay, a true crime podcast about gay people doing amazing, incredible, heroic, and historic things.